Word of
Mouth.
Word of
Mouth.
Word of
Mouth.
From New Hampshire Public Radio, this is Word of Mouth. I'm Virginia Prescott. Today on the program, Girl Power Grows Up. We'll hear from women who are opening up new conversations about women's roles and the F word, feminism. First up, Free to Be, You and Me, at 40. In the early 1970s, Free to Be, You and Me broke ground in the lives and minds of children across America. The brainchild of actress Marlo Thomas, the project included a best-selling book, a Peabody and Emmy Award-winning television special, and an album that went gold several times over. If you were a kid growing up in the 70s, you could probably still sing along today.
To a shining sea, and you and me are free to be.
In addition to its commercial success, Free to Be, You and Me encouraged kids to challenge gender and racial stereotypes through songs and skits voiced by Alan Alda, Carol Channing, Rosie Grier, and Thomas herself. Laura Lovett is professor of U.S. Women's History at UMass Amherst and co-editor of the book When We Were Free to Be, looking back at a children's classic and the difference it made. We talked with her about the origins of Free to Be and about what motivated Marlo Thomas, who millions of TV viewers knew as that girl, to take on the project.
Marlo Thomas had been one of the first female television producers in That Girl, and notoriously That Girl broke a lot of gender roles. In fact, she was famously unmarried. She was also the aunt to a niece and found herself really surprised when she tried to find some nighttime stories for her niece that reflected some of her ideas around gender. And that sort of led her to decide that she really needed to remake what children saw and heard.
So it was tremendously popular, won a lot of awards, as we mentioned, but it was also a product of the women's movement, and there was plenty of pushback and critics. Can you tell us about some of those complaints?
Some of them were about the broader vision of creating what was called a non-sexist movement. And so, in fact, socialization, the notion that, in fact, our gender roles are learned, was really seen by a group as an attack on the way that they thought boys and girls should be raised. And so the vision that, in fact, you could reimagine gender roles seemed particularly threatening. Other groups saw it as really kind of an attack. Jean Stafford of The New Yorker famously called it humorless bunkum and the inflexible piety of the Ms. Manifesto. Ms. Stafford, on the other hand, actually saw it as a little bit too focused on not disrupting the heterosexual nuclear family enough.
Well, let's listen to some of the songs themselves to hear how direct the message was. Here's Parents Are People. This is written by songwriter Carol Hall, sung here by Marlo Thomas and Harry Belafonte.
Mommies are people. Mommies were little, they used to be girls like some of you. But then they grew, and now mommies are women. Women with children. Busy with children and things that they do. There are a lot of things a lot of mommies can do. Some mommies are ranchers, or poetry makers, or doctors and teachers, or cleaners or bakers. Some mommies drive taxis, or sing on TV. Yeah, mommies can be almost anything they wanna be.
Well, they can't be grandfathers or daddies. Daddies are people.
So Carol Hall writes about it. She has an essay in the book and says that her children's views about gender helped shape that song. Talk about that.
Here she was a writer and really wound up challenging sort of her own idea of what she could do. But, you know, was making a living as a single mom with two kids, successfully writing. And her son was really surprised that she could write. In fact, he didn't understand the song suggesting that boys could be something besides doctors and that girls could be something besides nurses. Her daughter objected to her using the word women, in fact said that she should use ladies because ladies just sound so much nicer, and we all know that everyone is a nice lady.
Uh-huh. Well, you've been using Free to Be as a teaching tool in classes ranging from the history of childhood to gender. I'm wondering how your students, college students, are reacting when they hear songs like Mommies Are People.
My students, I came to this project because I began teaching this in a big survey history course, and I was trying to find a way to make students understand the impact of the women's movement, and I thought this was a kind of nice piece. And what I found was for my students, it was absolutely revelatory. They thought it was contemporary. To many of them, it seemed as if it were written just, you know, at this moment, because we're back to a moment when I think children have kind of pink and blue targeted at them. And my students were really surprised at the kind of the funniness, at the clever attack on media assumptions about roles and gender roles. I would play the CD in class, and typically some student would ask to borrow it, and then I would never see the CD again because it would get circulated around the dorms, and I'd have to go buy another one.
We're talking about The Legacy of Free to Be You and Me. That's a record, a television special, and a book created by actress Marlo Thomas in the early 1970s. Our guest is Laura Lovett. She's co-founder of the Journal of the History of Childhood and Youth and co-editor of When We Were Free to Be You and Me. Here's a clip from Housework. This is another song and skit here performed by Carol Channing.
You know, there are times when we happen to be just sitting there quietly watching TV when the program we're watching will stop for a while, and suddenly someone appears with a smile and starts to show us how terribly urgent it is to buy some brand of detergent, or soap or cleanser or cleaner or powder or paste or wax or bleach to help with the housework. Now, most of the time, it's a lady we see who's doing the housework on TV. She's cheerfully scouring a skillet or two, or she's polishing pots till they gleam like new, or she's scrubbing the tub, or she's mopping the floors, or she's wiping the stains from the walls and the doors, and she's washing the windows, the dishes, the clothes, or
40 years ago, I mean, we could be seeing this today. As many men as I now know sharing childcare responsibility or being stay-at-home dads or, you know, stay-at-home makers, there's very little representation of that population on television.
Not only that, but it's a critique of, you know, what we do see and what gets normalized then as normal roles. In my graduate women's history course, I often sometimes get a really mixed reaction when I ask my students, who are all in what they think of as very equitable relationships, who winds up doing the toilet cleaning.
You wrote a piece for the book on play and the role of toys in shaping children's attitudes. Let's hear. Now, this is the song that speaks to this on the album. This is William's Doll, performed by Alan Alda.
When my friend William was 5 years old, he wanted a doll to hug and hold.
A doll,
said William,
is what I need to wash and clean and dress and feed. A doll to give a bottle to and put to bed when day is through. And any time my doll gets ill, I'll take good care of it,
said my friend Bill.
So in this song, William's dad refuses to get him a doll. In the end, his grandmother buys him one, pointing out that he may be a father one day. How do kids who have grown up to become parents, I mean, how has it changed attitudes about gender roles that we impose on kids?
Well, we have changed our notion of what masculinity is in terms of fatherhood. It's really unusual now to imagine a father not being at the birth of a child, for example, or able to take care of a baby, maybe to change diapers and to help. And so I think we've really kind of reimagined what those roles are. But we also live in a world where sometimes it's very hard to entirely see that. One of the contributors to our book is a woman named Cheryl Kilo Davis, and she published a book called My Princess Boy, which talked about her son who liked to dress in beautiful dresses. He was 4 or 5 and just liked to express himself. And she began with a conversation about the fact that her son was carrying a pink backpack. Another little boy commented on it, and actually wasn't – the boy said, oh, isn't that beautiful? Right. It was the boy's father who said, how can you let him carry that? So I think that, you know, while we have changed some of our ideas, I think we still have a way of reinforcing certain traditional ideas.
Laura, we have a minute left, but I'm thinking that in addition to reframing notions of gender, reading this reminded me of the emergence of a very kid-centric culture. I mean, many people were faulting the women's movement, second wave feminism, you know, active in the 60s and 70s, with leaving the family behind and child rearing behind. Free to Be sort of debunks that for me.
Absolutely. I think Free to Be is one of the three major texts for the women's movement. And we often forget that this was really a central piece of it. In fact, it was based on initially the fact that Ms. Magazine, from its very inaugural issue, had a series called Stories for Free Children, and very much a vision that, in fact, we needed to support the family and to really kind of reimagine family as we reimagined roles for women and for men.
Well, Laura, I want to thank you for joining us as we listen to Rosie Grier, former football star, singing It's All Right to Cry. I thank you for your time today.
Thank you for having me.
It's all right to cry. Crying gets the sad out of you. It's all right to cry. It might make you feel better.
Laura Lovett, along with Lori Rotzkoff, is editor of When We Were Free to Be. It's a collection of essays providing a retrospective look at the origins and the messaging and changes brought about by Free to Be You and Me. That was a media project from the early 1970s. And of course, we'd love to hear from you. While prepping for this segment, we discovered that Free to Be You and Me is one of those things you either know or you don't. Did you have it as a kid? Did you memorize the songs as we, the word-of-mouth women, did? Did it change the way you look at and teach your own kids, especially if you have a boy who's always wanted a doll? We'd love to hear your comment on our lively conversation now taking place on our Facebook page.
Mean and ugly, sloppy, slappy, hoppy, happy, change and change and change. To cry, little boy. I know some big boys that cry too.
This is Judy Benjamin.
Oh my!
That's for the future, not Lord and Taylor. You know.
All her life, she got everything she ever wanted, and a few things she didn't.
I did join the army, but I joined a different army. I joined the one with the condos and the private rooms.
In the 1980 film Private Benjamin, Goldie Hawn plays a city girl who's duped into joining the army. The joke, of course, is that far from the glamorous life she was promised, she ends up in boot camp, a trying, humiliating experience that pushes her physical and emotional limits. Nowadays, when people talk about boot camp, they're most likely referring to grueling workout routines designed to get people into shape fast. But when Amy Richards and Jennifer Baumgartner offer their boot camp in New York City, it is not military training or abs of steel they promise. It is feminism. And Amy Richards is here to tell us more. Welcome to Word of Mouth.
Thank you for having me.
So what exactly is feminist boot camp?
Feminist boot camp is a week-long intensive where mostly college students, undergraduate, graduate, professors, faculty, unaffiliated, come and experience feminism in action. Each day is a different theme: philanthropy, media, sexual rights, reproductive justice. And the point is both to connect the dots of feminism, meaning that it's not what I think it's always portrayed to be in the media. It's also meant to kind of expose people to the sort of practical application of feminism. What does it actually mean when somebody practices feminism, and how can that be a part of their daily lives, and if not, their professional lives?
Well, I mean, this is coming at a time when many women do not describe themselves as feminists, don't even like the connotation. Aren't the people who would sign up for a feminist boot camp already sort of true believers?
I'm surprised that each session we've done, and we're, I think, going on 12, there's always one, two, three, four people who sort of say, I don't really know what feminism means to me. In our last session, we had a daughter who came and who felt very connected to feminism, an undergraduate student, and she brought her mother along. And her mother came along because she cared about her daughter and saw this was something that her daughter cared about. And she was one of those people who thought, I've never really thought about feminism. And I think she left one of the biggest converts and even said, I think I might have to get a new job by the end of the week. And we've had other people who are really encouraged by their professors who say, I just think you might get something out of this. Other people are sort of encouraged by a friend. And I think some people see it as a job, you know, exposure journey and think, oh, okay, well, the feminism is secondary. And then get on the trip and inevitably everybody sort of realizes, oh, my gosh, the feminism is more a part of my life than I ever realized. Mm.
I think of boot camp and I think of people running through tires and doing squats and things. What are some of the exercises you put campers through?
Well, the most rigorous, I would say, in terms of physical fitness, a more traditional boot camp, is we have done some wonderful self-empowerment, self-defense trainings, mm-hmm. and they get in their sweatpants and they get to scream no and they, you know, have a man dressed up in tons of armor and they get to kick and scream and yell. And that said, as much as it's a physical exercise, it's really an emotional one. It's learning what our boundaries are. It's learning, you know, whether it's our mother or our boss or a potential perpetrator, how we can say, no, that doesn't make me feel comfortable, and getting women to realize when they do feel safe and comfortable.
Okay, so you mentioned men, women defending themselves against men. Do only women come to feminist boot camp?
Every session we've done, we've always had a male participant or a transgender or someone transitioning. So not only are the participants very inclusive of men, I mean, that said, women definitely dominate. But many of the meetings that we have throughout the week, there are male representatives, you know, and it could be that we're going to NARAL Pro-Choice New York, and the director of their advocacy program is a young man, and he's talking to them. Or we might go to the Novo Foundation and talk about philanthropy, and the person who does their social emotional learning is a man, and he might do some of the philanthropy exercise with us. So men are also a part of the week. And I think also important is that the masculinity is a part of the week, and challenging, I think, what still happens in culture, which is that we've done a wonderful job of empowering women. We've not done a great job of deflating the value of masculinity, and that's something that can benefit women who don't typically sort of fit into those stereotypes, and any man who isn't sort of neatly, you know, adhering to what society has defined as being a good man or for the value of masculinity.
Well, that's interesting. It makes me wonder why you use a terminology like boot camp, which has long stood for, you know, enhancing masculinity, for training men, for prepping them for war.
It's funny, we've gone through different names, and the camp name really sticks, and it is most likened to a camp experience, meaning you kind of arrive, and you don't really know who your bunkmates are going to be, and you don't know a lot of the people in the group, and you're sort of thrown into it, and the days are long, and I mean, we don't sing Kumbaya, but we have moments like that throughout the week. And then, you know, we've sort of taken sometimes to the boot and then left the boot, and, you know, and it's funny that even when we don't call it boot camp, other people do call it boot camp. And so I do think there is just something about the rigorousness of it that people can embrace. And now that women can be on the front line of combat, I think that we're less scared of what the boot camp connotation can bring.
The HBO show Girls, the new book, Bleep, I'm in My 20s. We have these millennial portraits of women as lost, as immature, lacking confidence, really the antithesis of a feminist. Is that your experience?
It's not my experience at all. I mean, I see young women and I think, oh my gosh, I wish I was that confident and strong when I was that age. I mean, even Lena Dunham, you know, the mastermind behind Girls, feeling confident that you can pitch your own show and go out there and do it and be in control and not necessarily be a predictable starlet to do that in is amazing. And I see that in less famous versions every single day. I see young women more willing to take up space and more willing to say, that doesn't work for me. And that's a wonderful consequence of feminism.
Amy Richards, co-director of the Feminist Boot Camp and co-author of the book Manifesta, Young Women, Feminism, and the Future. Thank you so much for joining
us. Thanks so much for having me.
Coming up, author Megan Abbott shares her vision of girl power, high school cheerleaders. Her novel, Dare Me, digs beneath the ponytails and glitter and gets a little bit noir. We'll hear about that when Word of Mouth continues.
Word of mouth.
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 Well, Duff, move.
From New Hampshire Public Radio, this is Word of Mouth. I'm Virginia Prescott.
Missy is bank.
Bankrupt? We've already so decided on Jamie.
Brittany, this is not a democracy. It's a cheerocracy. I'm sorry, but I'm overruling you.
Kirsten Dunst there from Bring It On, a film which pretty much embedded cheerleaders in contemporary culture as a perky, cliquish, and generally vapid lot. Author Megan Abbott recast the cheerleader trope in her novel Dare Me, which is now out in paperback. The cheerleaders in the novel Sutton Grove High have more to think about than their spray tans. Their pretty, hard-driving coach holds the squad in her thrall. She has less control over her own life, which opens up a dark tale of jealousy, physical and psychological abuse, and a mysterious death. We spoke with Megan Abbott and asked her about the new genre she may have opened up with this book, Cheerleader Noir.
I do think it's definitely new, but it shouldn't be.
Yeah, there's plenty of material there, huh?
Right, exactly.
Were you a cheerleader in high school?
No, it's sort of ironic, and anyone who knew me in high school would find it deeply so, because I was more the editor of the school paper kind of girl.
Almost an anti-cheerleader, I would
think. Yeah, well, yes. But cheerleading was quite different then, I have to say. It was much more, this is the 80s, it was much more of the, you know, pom-pom shake sort of hip swinging. It wasn't the athletic pursuit that it is today. Not that I was athletic either, but it's definitely changed since then as well.
So why did you choose cheerleading then? What was the appeal?
I really stumbled upon it. In my last book, I had a character who was a field hockey player, and so I started watching some clips of girls playing field hockey, and the ferocity of them on the field and this kind of wild freedom they seemed to have was just so intriguing to me, and the idea that there might be a place for girls to have a healthy outlet for aggression and competition and ambition. And then it sort of led me to cheerleading because it's become the most dangerous high school sport. So I started watching clips of it and just became riveted at the lengths that these girls will go to for their sport.
Yeah, the danger of the sport. And there's a girl sitting on the sidelines at the squad because of an injury she sustained. And she's looking at them and realizing that when they're performing stunts, it looks like they're trying to kill each other.
Right, yes, exactly.
Is this like just the, you know, general recklessness of youth, or is there something particularly competitive or aggressive about the nature of young women?
I think it's both. I think, you know, all teenagers are a little nihilistic and also have that illusion of immortality, you know, that they really don't think anything could happen to them. But I do think it's just there's so few places where girls today are allowed to have any of these dark feelings or express them. They're just, especially the girls who end up being cheerleaders, who do tend to be the most all-American, let's just say, there's just no place for them to say bad things or to express bad thoughts. So somehow I think all that energy gets to play out doing these stunts, and that ambition, there's nothing threatening about it because they're supposed to want to do it. So it's sort of given full rein.
Well, there's plenty of room for bad thoughts inside of this book. However, and in their brains, and in the main sort of characters here, we have Beth, who's been the sort of head girl, queen bee, captain of the cheerleading squad, and her friend Addie, her forever lieutenant. This has been the relationship since peewee cheerleading squads for them. And then there is the coach French, Colette French, who's this pretty, very put together new coach. She's 27 and in many ways kind of embodies what all of those girls want to be, except for Beth. There's a real battle of wills between her and Beth. What's going on there?
your cheerleading coaches in particular tend to be not that much older than cheerleaders often, and sometimes they've just been out of high school a few years. So they're just far enough in age to be more mentorly, but not so far in age that the girls don't want to be like them and don't want to identify with them. And so the power can be really intense. And Beth, you know, as someone who has been queen bee, she distinctly had somewhat occupied that role, and she feels really dethroned, and she's the only one who is not captivated and sees this as a real power struggle. I ended up starting to think about it as almost like a Shakespearean, you know, Richard III was kind of my model, that this would be a fight for the throne and who would hold the power and which leader would hold sway, you know, the good leader or the bad leader, and which would dominate.
But we do mostly live inside of Addie Hanlon. She's the narrator. And this book was written in the first person, which is a difficult thing, especially in the present tense. It's a difficult way to tell a story. Now, why did you choose this format?
It is. I felt that it's very easy to view, especially particular cheerleading, as kitsch. It's sort of been trapped in kitsch and in pop culture and in irony. And I felt if we were in the head of someone doing it, we would have to sort of tear off those trappings. It would have to feel really real. And if we were in Addie's head in particular, she's not the queen bee. She's, you know, that sort of second-in-command person has always interested me, because you always wonder, you know, what their motive is, and have they ever thought about being queen bee themselves?
Well, she may not be the queen bee, but she's pretty unapologetically a mean girl. I mean, did you worry about making her nice enough for readers?
It's so funny because people have said that to me, and I, of course, you go native when you write these things and you start to like everybody. And I'm sure she would have tormented me in high school, of course, but in writing her, even writing Beth, in some ways even more so Beth, I grew to love, sort of admire, and then ultimately love them, because they're so committed, they're so dedicated. You know, Addie is so full force, and I guess in the end, they sort of seduced me.
Well, Megan, I'd love to hear you read a little bit from the book Dare Me. First, give us a little bit of background on what's going on here.
Sure. This is from the very beginning, and as you say, it's first person, so it's Addie's point of view, and she's essentially describing what it's like to come out of a competition and, you know, essentially strip off her war paint, as I sort of consider the cheerleader costume, and she sort of thinks a little bit about what cheer means to her. After a game, it takes a half hour under the shower head to get all the hairspray out, to peel off all the sequins, to dig out that last bobby pin nestled deep in your hair. Sometimes you stand under the hot gush for so long, looking at your body, counting every bruise, touching every tender place, watching the swirl at your feet, the glitter spinning, like a mermaid shedding her scales. You're really just trying to get your heart to slow down. You think, this is my body, and I can make it do things. I can make it spin, flip, fly. After, you stand in front of the steaming mirror, the fuchsia streaks gone, the lashes unsparkled, and it's just you there, and you look like no one you've ever seen before. You don't look like anybody at all. At first, cheer was something to fill my days, all our days. Ages 14 to 18, a girl needs something to kill all that time, that endless, itchy waiting, every hour, every day, for something, anything to begin. There's something dangerous about the boredom of teenage girls. Coach said that once, one fall afternoon long ago. But she said it not like someone's mom or a teacher or the principal or, worst of all, a guidance counselor. She said it like she knew and understood. The more I did it, the more it owned me. It made things matter. It put a spine into my spineless life, and that spine spread into backbone, ribs, collarbone, neck held high. It was something. Don't say it wasn't. And Coach gave it all to us.
Well, I kind of smell movie on this one, I have to say. I mean, can you imagine anyone as your ideal, Addie or Beth or Coach?
I guess one of those Fanning girls would probably be great for the for the cheerleaders. I think I did sort of picture that kind of girl. I never exactly cast in my head, but I grew up obsessed with movies, so I certainly did think especially with all the stunts, visually how powerful they can be. And in the year of Hunger Games, it seems like finally girls are getting attention at last, which is a great thing.
Well, Megan, I really want to thank you for your time today.
Great. Thank you so much. This is wonderful.
Megan Abbott is the Edgar Award-winning author of Queenpin and The End of Everything, which is now out in paperback. Her new book is called Dare Me. For more on the book, including links to reviews, you can go to wordofmouthradio.org. Megan, thank you so much. I will admit now that when I was in junior high school, I went to cheerleading camp.
I wanted to ask, but that's awesome.
And now to the only book club we can think of that is dominated by men. Earlier this year, we came across an infographic that went viral among bookish types on Facebook and on Twitter. VIDA, an organization for women in the literary arts, released the results of VIDA Count 2012. That's a tally of male and female book reviewers at major publications, including The Atlantic, Harper's, and The New York Times Book Review, and the gender of authors they reviewed over the past 3 years. Jason Bogue is editor of the publishing website Gallicat, where he blogged about the findings. Jason, great to have you back on Word of Mouth.
Hi, it's always fun to be here.
So why has VIDA Count 2012 caused such a stir, Jason?
Yeah, this year, sadly, the story isn't the fact that this problem exists. It's that it's not getting any better. These VIDA numbers have been reported for 3 years now. In some cases, in some major magazines, the count is still either going down or not getting any better. A good example here is Harper's Magazine. When the count was first taken for 2010, they had 6 women versus 27 men reviewing books. And if you looked at the count of authors that they were reviewing, 21 were women and 46 were men. But you go to 2012, these numbers are down. Only 3 women wrote book reviews in 2012 at Harper's, and 28 men wrote book reviews. So we're seeing a real stark difference there, and things just aren't improving.
Looks pretty much the same across the board. Granta, New York, The Times Literary Supplement, The New Yorker, The Nation, Boston Review of Books. Give us a little insider's view of book reviewing. How are books chosen? Is it up to the reviewers, editors, and why this huge gender gap?
You know, here at Gallicat, I get so many books. Every day, probably 10 to 15 books are pitched to us for review consideration or for feature consideration. And we don't even really run traditional reviews the same way that these publications do. So the publications that run traditional reviews, they have giant rooms filled with books. They just receive books every single day. And editors and editorial assistants are sorting through those all the time, trying to find what books the magazine wants to cover. Also, you have a lot of freelance writers out there who are trying to pitch stories. They'll put together packages and try to suggest things that they would want to review themselves.
I'm looking at figures here. Harper's, you mentioned 3 women reviewers, 28 men, 4 times as many reviews by men at The Atlantic, at the New York Review of Books, 40 bylines by women, 215 by men. And we look at how those numbers seem to pan out on the product. Maybe the most egregious New York Times book review, where 17,000 books by men were reviewed compared to 7,400 by women. Plenty of comments out there on the internet about this. Scores of so-called literary books are published by women each year, but that they are relegated to genre categories in a way that books by men aren't. Can you think of examples of that?
Yeah, we've seen a lot of complaints about that in the past, and I think up until 2012, 2013, it could seriously affect someone's career. Writers like Jodi Picoult and other people getting pushed to the sidelines a little bit, but I really think the landscape has drastically changed right now. The way people buy books, these literary magazines aren't really shaping the conversation for readers as much as they used to.
Wow.
I think you're seeing places like Amazon and Goodreads, which is a site where lots of readers share their personal reviews of books. Those are driving the conversation more than anything. And at Goodreads, they recently released a survey of 1,000 of their readers, and book reviews didn't even factor into the decision people are making to buy. Trusted Friend or Book Club were the majority of the things driving these decisions to buy a book.
Boy, that is a whole story in itself, isn't it?
Mm-hmm.
Jason Bogue, editor of Gallicat, managing editor of App Newser, thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you.
Now, you can find a lot more about VIDA's 2012 count and a link to the pretty startling infographics therein on our Facebook page at Word of Mouth Radio. Coming up, The Devolution of Wonder Woman. A filmmaker follows images of the greatest female superhero through time and considers the sad state of role models for girls today. We'll throw the truth lasso around that story when Word of Mouth continues.
Word of mouth.
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 Mouth.
From New Hampshire Public Radio, this is Word of Mouth. I'm Virginia Prescott. One thing common to superheroes, their names usually end with man.
Spider-Man.
Superman.
Batman. Like all the classics.
Batman.
You know what I'm saying? Batman's dope.
Can't stand Batman.
Spider-Man.
Superman.
Catwoman.
Clark Kent.
Is she a superhero?
I think so.
I think she, like, turns into a superhero.
Wonder Woman?
Wonder Woman, yeah, for sure.
Wonder Woman.
Wonder Woman! Wonder Woman! Wonder Woman has yet to be the subject of a major motion picture, until now, sort of. Wonder Women, the untold story of American superheroines, is a documentary that follows the character from her Amazonian origins to that campy TV show in the 70s, to her following among punk rockers, suburban girls, and even Gloria Steinem. Christy Guevara Flanagan directed the film. Christy, welcome to Word of Mouth.
Thank you.
I was pretty stunned to learn that Wonder Woman was actually the invention of a man, the psychologist William Moulton Marston. Can you tell us a little bit more about him? Quite a character.
He was quite a character, and that was really where my investigation began. I hadn't thought too much about Wonder Woman until I read an article mentioning Gail Simone, who was writing the comic at the time for DC. And in the article, it said that it was the first time it had ever been written by a woman. And so I went back and decided to find out who created her in the first place and why, and was surprised to find out that it was a man, and it was William Moulton Marston, who created her in 1941. So she's really been around for nearly as long as Superman and emerged from this golden age of comics. Now, at that time, a lot of the people creating comics were not familiar with the form because it was in its beginnings. It hadn't really been developed yet. So William Moulton Marston was actually a pop psychologist. He'd written some books. He was actually the inventor of the lie detector test and was really interested in ways to figure out if people were telling the truth or not, which comes into play in Wonder Woman.
The golden lasso.
With her lasso, right, which is her superpower. And the only superhero, as far as I know, where one of their powers is that they can make people tell the truth. And he had this very kind of radical, I think, for his time, idea that he wanted to create a superheroine that was going to be different from the other male heroes out there and wasn't just going to use her strength to solve crime and save the day and be the hero. She was going to use diplomacy. She was going to forgive people after they'd done wrong. And she was going to nurture as well.
Well, let's talk a little bit about how she changed over time. The first issue of the comic came out in December of 1941. So the U.S. engaged in World War II. She's fighting Nazis. But after the war, we have the kind of father knows best era of House Wiffery. So bring us through some of the ebbs and flows of Wonder Woman's personality and power.
Well, that was another thing that interested me in the characters. Here you have this long-lasting female heroine, but the way that she's been created and treated throughout the decades has been radically different. And I think it has a lot to do with how society has viewed women and women in leadership as heroes.
All over the United States, women are called upon to leave their homes and take jobs. They discover that factory work is usually no more difficult than housework.
So in the 40s, it was kind of a very important time for women. They were working outside of the home. They were called upon by the country to become factory workers and to step outside of the home when the men were at war. Then when the war is over, well, men need their jobs. Our economy is fueled by these guys being the primary breadwinners, especially at that time. So you see popular culture reflections of women then become that kind of Ozzie and Harriet or father knows best depictions where women are very much at home and cooking and cleaning and making dinner every night. And And Wonder Woman was not different. So where she had been really powerful and going off and fighting the axis of evil, by the 50s, when you saw these other kind of female characters lose their strength in many ways, she was doing the same thing. Now, part of that might have had to do with the fact that her creator, William Moulton Marston, had passed, and she floundered for quite a bit. So she began to revolve around stories of romance, where she used to save her Steve Trevor, who was the main love interest in the series. She used to always save his butt, you know. Here he was all of a sudden carrying her and saving her. So the roles were completely reversed from the original intention.
One of the great peaks for Wonder Woman, however, came in the 1970s when she was played by Linda Carter. Now here is Linda Carter in a scene from your film, Wonder Women.
There was a comment made to me before I was cast. Well, if you get this, you know, you're going to have a lot of women hating you. And I went, huh? What? You know, that's not Wonder Woman. So I went about really deciding how I wanted her to be.
I'm not afraid of you. Do you understand that?
I've never wanted you to be afraid of me.
She would be interested in the community of women. Certainly not against men, but for the community of women. No, not a man.
A scene there from Wonder Women, the untold story of American superheroines. We're speaking to the director of the film, Christy Guevara Flanagan. So I guess there was this point in the 1970s when we have a couple of at least good examples of strong and powerful women. But then we also have Charlie's Angels. So, you know, while these women are strong, they always seem to somehow make their way into bikinis. What's going on here?
Well, I think that's true, and I think that still holds true today, but definitely in the 70s, it was the first time these women were able to play these kind of action-packed heroes on TV. So they were first. They were breaking new ground. Of course, they still had to appeal to men as well, and I think the way that you do that is make them very foxy and sexy. So I think Charlie's Angels are kind of an extreme version of that, and almost, you know, for camp purposes, they were heroes, but they were always found in these ridiculous situations where they had to wear a bikini or they happened to be, you know, in a towel in the gym locker and they were, you know, solving the crime that way.
Once upon a time, there were three little girls who went to the police academy.
At the time, in the 70s, it was still pretty revolutionary, you know, to have three women starring in a TV show. And in Charlie's Angels, you know, their boss was a disembodied voice.
He was just on a speakerphone.
So he really didn't exist.
And now they work for me. My name is Charlie.
So that's what was revolutionary about it. It wasn't necessarily the way they dressed, but it was the way they acted. And you had to kind of take both at the same time, because that's all that there was out there, and that was cutting edge. What to me is sad is that we still are kind of having those same battles today. You still have our female superheroes wearing very little clothing or, you know, just really kind of dolled up for their roles, kicking butt, but at the same time looking, you know, like a Budweiser ad. Mm. So I would like to have hoped that we could have come a little bit farther in those 40 years since those shows have come out.
I'm going to say even more so, this kind of idealized body. I mean, I think a lot of the female characters from video games, for one thing, you know, a lot of sort of internet culture is these sort of hyper female bodies. And I guess there's always the argument that men's bodies are also hyper masculinized in comics.
Well, I think that both body types are ideal. Definitely in comics, you have the male ideal of what's supposed to be the strong man. But ultimately, they are treated differently if you really analyze it. I mean, the women, their sexuality is usually part of the plot, you know, so who they love and how they love and why they're, you know, why violence is enacted upon them is usually because of their sexuality, where it's different for men. It's not quite the same. And ultimately, the men are the ones that usually save the day. And a lot of times, these strong female characters are dead by the end of the story. They're sacrificed or they kill themselves. It's almost like the message is that they can't control the power that they do have. They just can't exist in the reality of this universe. So they have to give up everything, which is their life.
I'd love to go back to this sort of timeline of evolving images. We do see during the 1980s, let's say the Reagan years, that's the parallel I think you draw in the film, that women sort of revert. And then at the end of the 80s, you have a little bit of an upswing. You have Ripley in Aliens. You have Sarah Connor in The Terminator, G.I. Jane, and finally Thelma and Louise. I mean, some hardcore women. But you also have in the 1990s the sort of beginning of this Riot Girl movement, led largely by Kathleen Hanna. That was the name of her zine, Riot Girl. She was also from the band Bikini Kill. She is also in your film talking about the images of women and this idea of girl power.
There's like so few images of powerful women that women get desperate and they're like, okay, that's powerful. And we'll just take any kind of garbage or crumb off the table that we can find and claim that as something that's powerful, even when it's kind of not. We wrote a fanzine in 1991 called Bikini Kill 2 Girl Power. It said girl power on the cover. It was the first time anybody supposedly had ever said that. And then 3 years later, Spice Girls.
This is about girl power, so come on!
And they were like, girl power, wear high heels, girl power. And it was like, it just became a part of the wallpaper. Every time I see it, I just kind of cringe.
That's Kathleen Hanna, formerly of the band Bikini Kill. She's founder of Riot Girl, the zine. And that's a scene from Wonder Woman, the untold story of American superheroines. We're speaking with the director, Christy Guevara Flanagan. Christy, tell me a little bit about that. I really feel like one of the most moving things about this film for me was seeing young girls on the street being asked about, you know, who would they be as a superpower or who do they look to? Or young girls dressed up at Comic-Con as Wonder Woman looking for some sort of heroine to emulate or making films, you know, girls making films about girls. What are they looking at? What are the models for them now?
Well, I think everybody needs role models, you know, women and men, boys and girls, people of different ethnicities, and they need those role models to look like they look. So you can have, you know, a lawyer and a doctor be role models, but you also need characters that kind of have that physical strength to really battle the villains. And there's not a lot of options out there still to this day for girls. And you look at it from animated cartoons to superhero comics to the action blockbusters of the day. There's few women and few girls that are taking the roles of heroes. You know, part of what we have to do is make our own. And I think part of the reason you don't see a lot of heroes that represent women is because a lot of the studio execs, the people in real leadership positions, aren't women. So I think once women start taking on positions of power in the media, that is, you know, directing, writing, and producing, executive producing, you'll see more diversity in terms of gender representation.
Well, there are rumors of Joss Whedon, the creator of Buffy the Vampire Slayer, making a Wonder Woman film starring Megan Fox, possibly. Do you have high hopes for a film like that?
Well, there's been lots of attempts at making a Wonder Woman action film. And it's just so surprising that it hasn't happened. I mean, how many different versions
right.
of
how
Superman
many Justice League stars
Batman,
have come? Right.
I know. Have there been? And there's this idea, well, one, you know, we got to get it right. There's too many different versions of Wonder Woman out there. But, you know, I mean, they're not afraid to fail with Superman or Batman because the merchandise, the copyright, the figure is so strong and well-known. It can suffer, you know, different versions of it on screen. And the other idea is that women don't do well starring in films when it comes to action blockbusters, which I just, you know, you look at The Hunger Games, or you look at Twilight, and that's just not true. You know, there just hasn't been material that women have wanted to see. And so if you make the film, they will come. Hmm. And I think Wonder Woman would be a great place to start.
Christy Guevara Flanagan, director of Wonder Woman, the untold story of American superheroines. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
After speaking with Christy, we asked some of the women here at NHPR what their preferred superpower would be.
I want to be able to jump tall buildings in a single bound.
The mega brain. Self-styling hair.
Invisibility. Do you want me to explain why?
I think if I could go around with no one seeing me, I would know all the secrets, and I like knowing secrets.
To be able to fly, it's just so free, and I dream it a lot, but I really would like to do it.
My superpower would be having perfect memory, being able to remember everything except when I didn't want to. And then I could voluntarily unremember something.
Making sure no kid goes hungry. I think that an advocate of food for all and getting good, accessible local food for those who are in need, especially.
Whatever your gender, you can share your wished-for superpower on our Facebook page, Word of Mouth Radio. And we thank you for joining us on our mission for world domination of sorts. If you'd like to learn more about anything you heard on the program, you can click on over to wordofmouthradio.org, where we've posted links and photos and videos, and where you can find a deep archive of conversations about more ideas to stir your curiosity. I'm Virginia Prescott, and this is Word of Mouth from New Hampshire Public Radio.
Word of Mouth is produced by Taylor Quimby,
Zach Nugent,
and Bill Barry.
And senior producer Rebecca Lavoie.
Sarah Plord is our digital producer.
And Dan Colgan runs our board.
The views expressed in this program
are those of the individuals
and not those of NHPR, its board of trustees,
or its underwriters.
To subscribe to our podcast
and listen to past shows, go to wordofmouthradio.org.
You can also join us on Facebook and Tumblr.
Follow us on Twitter.
And check out a playlist of music from the program
on Spotify.
Word of Mouth is a production
of New Hampshire
Public Radio.